Hello folks, welcome back to the 1001 Arabian Nights, where we try to convey to you guys the amazing history of the Arabs from the mist of time to today. I'm your host, Aban Arikabi.
And I'm your host, Houston Rufai.
And in this episode, we're going to be talking about the king of the lost civilizations of the desert, the Nabataeans, who are most famous for their capital and crowning achievement, the stone city of Petra. Now the Nabataeans, tell me, what do you know about the Nabataeans, other than they were once ancient beings, a group of nomads roaming the earth far and wide, and the north of Arabia is where they reside, with big temples carved inside rocks, a sight to behold, with riches the likes ye has never seen, basking in mounds of gold. Masters of trade, they grew strong and wealthy, jealousy and threat was a result of their notoriety. For Rome could not let a wealthy bunch slip from her grip. Annexation was a result of a few legions' trip. Although they were annexed, their progeny lived on to defeat Rome and the coming of Islam.
Oof, got the chills there. I didn't know we started a poetry slam, man.
Hey, man, the Arabs are a poetic people, so we got to introduce the subject with poetry.
I agree.
But, that's just how it works, man.
But this is how I like to introduce the topic. So, how do we know about Petra? Because for the longest time, the only thing we ever heard about it was from ancient Greek sources where they also, like, we'll get to it, but they kind of made stuff up about it, too, that was kind of fantastical. But They described where the place was and, like, how important it was to the trade system. But we didn't know where it was because this had been, like, lost territory. And because the Bedouin who lived in the area liked to keep their little secrets about their like territory, you know?
Because they probably had bad experiences with having their territory exposed.
That is true.
And Rome also did annex them once they figured out, oh man, these guys are pretty rich.
And for like the couple hundred years before, they liked using it as like a little hideout too, like especially the tombs and stuff. Anyways,
it's true.
So
yeah.
How do we know about Petra? We know it because, and the wider world knows about it because of some crazy Swiss guy named Johann Ludwig Burckhardt. Anyways, I'm not doing that right. Anyways, this guy became like one of these Orientalists who became obsessed with the East and the Arabs especially, to the point where as he was studying Arabic in one of these Western universities, he eventually started calling himself Sheikh Ibrahim Ibn Abdullah.
That's a far cry from Johann Ludwig Burckhardt.
I know. And he started dressing like your stereotypical Ottoman like era guy. He started dressing in robes and presenting himself as the Arab expert, even though he'd never been.
Man, it sounds like this is like cultural appropriation at its finest.
Oh man, it would so not fly these days. But back then it was like, ooh, how interesting, how exotic.
It's Halloween every day for this guy.
So his little trip started getting him like hired by different organizations, specifically the London Africa Association. So he became their employee. And honestly, he doesn't write it this way, but it kind of sounds like he scammed the shit out of them. So what I'm talking about here is they hired him to try to discover the source of the Niger River in West Africa.
Okay.
He convinced them that he needed to go practice his Arabic, but not in like West Africa where that might make sense. He decided to go to Egypt and Syria to go practice his Arabic. And they financed his studies to go to Egypt. And it just doesn't make any sense. Anyways, so they send him over there. And he goes around in disguise. Like, he goes around, like, learning Arabic. At one point, he starts trying to, like, he tries to, like, practice his Arabic. And he thinks he's good enough that he goes in disguise as, like, a poor traveler. And, like, he learned Arabic as an adult. So there's no chance he doesn't have an accent.
Yeah, it wouldn't fly off.
He's like this white guy pretending to be Arab. Like, maybe if he had perfect Arabic, he might pass for like some like,
for like a Syrian or like something.
But no, he's completely off his rocker doing this. And like, apparently nobody told him this. I believe he was good enough to like pass, like go around and like spend his time and stuff. But there's no way he didn't pass. So
whoever was responsible of this, anyways, probably wasn't that proficient in Arabic. Like, okay, you probably pass. I don't know.
No, but like the Arabs that he's interacting with never call him on that because of like, you know, it's the Borat principle. This is like a white Borat in the middle of like the Middle East where he's like, yes, of course, my English is perfect. Blah, blah.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's like you understand what he's saying, but you don't want to like interrupt his little shtick. So he's like walking around a couple times. He's like, success. I am now undercover.
I am now 100%
Arab. I'm undercover. Anyways, whatever. So this story is just great. So he figures out that like there might be like this ancient city, so because he's heard stories from the Arabs, like of like the tomb next to the tomb of Harun is like this ancient city, but nobody tells anybody where it exactly is.
Harun, by the way, guys, is Aaron, the prophet Aaron, the brother of Moses, the prophet Moses.
Exactly. And in their journey out of the Sinai, they go through this territory. By tradition, they go through this territory. So it kind of makes sense, and it also relates to the Judeo-Christian Islamic history of this topic. Anyways, what's great is he ends up going to the City of Stone and tricks them into going through to actually see the treasury of Petra, that like famous place, you know? And while he's like gawking at it and taking notes, his guide clearly seems pissed off because he's taking notes. He's going to like expose the place. What the fuck are you doing? And he calls him like an infidel or something.
Yeah.
And he thought he was going to get killed. So
because it's supposed to be a secret.
Exactly. But he writes in his diary like he was going to get killed or something. But there's no evidence to suggest that. But anyways, he paid them to take him to the tomb of Aaron, and he tricked them into revealing the location, and the guides were extremely pissed, but he didn't get in trouble at all. The way he talks about them is also really silly. Like, quote, I was without protection in the midst of a desert where no traveler had ever before been seen. Not true. Future travelers may visit the spot under protection of an armed force. The inhabitants will become more accustomed to these researches of strangers. And the antiquities of Wadi Musa, the place next door, will then be found to rank amongst the most curious remains of ancient art. So that's his like assessment of this. Although clearly, like even though he seems to appreciate Arab culture and he got buried as a Muslim, he's still got that colonial
mindset. He does. He does. Yeah. You can kind of feel the arrogance a little bit.
The arrogance that just never goes away. But
a bit condescending in the tone, but.
Regardless, this is how the wider world found out about Petra. So I thought it was a cute story. Some Borat impression in the middle of the Arab world is great.
I mean, the greatest discoveries are made by accident. I'm not saying that this was an accident.
Yeah,
but
exactly. Like, you know. Okay, so why do we want to talk about the Nabataeans today? So what's so interesting to me about them is they relate to so many things that are relevant to today, and their story is just incredible. They go from the tent dwellers to the builders of one of the greatest cities in the ancient world.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so cool to talk about.
And also one thing about the Nabataeans is that they are, I would say, the front runners or the ancestors of the Arabic language.
They are. They take the Aramaic script and they turn it to, like, they spoke Aramaic as their, like, business language, but then they turned it into an Arabic script. They took their language and actually made it a literate language. They were the ones to do that, and it's their letters and their script that evolved into Arabic.
Yeah, I mean, they were speaking old Arabic, right? But which is the or a form of Arabic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, everybody has an old version of their language.
That became the classical Arabic.
Exactly.
And then it became to what we know today.
Exactly. And people try to deny how Arab the Nabataeans were. Like, today, the consensus is that they were Arabs who spoke Aramaic in their business interactions, like everyone else in the Fertile Crescent did.
It was the lingua franca at the time.
Exactly. But one of the reasons why they're so relevant today is that they are, like, it's a story that involves, like, climate change. It's the origins of the Palestinian and Jordanian people as Arab peoples and Arab lands. It's the story of how, and it involves the story of Christians, Jews, and later Muslims in how their origins happen in their interactions, especially their interactions between Jews and Arabs. And more importantly, or not more importantly, but very pertinent to right now, is that it is kind of a perfect Christmas special, actually, since, like, you know, so many Arabs are actually Christian.
True.
And it is the origins of the Christmas story that we know today, the nativity that, like, North American Christians are so familiar with. This is the story that we're going to explain.
And the Nabataeans had a big, big role in that story, in the story of the birth of Christ.
This is the time period, and this is the context. We're going to explain the context of it, including Herod the Great and the dark side of that story that we don't really talk about too much on, you know, Happy Holiday, but still. It gets dark, people. It gets dark.
Merry Christmas, guys.
Oh, fuck. Sorry. It's perfect for December. And how Jesus in the Christian tradition became a thing.
Yeah.
Of course, there's conflicting accounts, let's put it that way, of how he came about. But
the essence of it is kind of the same.
We can do a little aside about how we're going to talk about sources in this, because some sources are really good but short, and other sources are really detailed, but you'll see what we mean by that.
Flimsy.
They're flimsy. Like, I'm going to pick on Strabo specifically, because he has so much stuff to talk about the Arabs and all the different things that happen, but he's also half the time just making stuff up or misunderstanding things, because he never... It's like the telephone game where he's like reading sources.
He's a historian without being an explorer a little bit, you know. He just gets like secondhand, thirdhand sources about the Arabs or the Middle East.
All right, so like here's how he would describe the Nabataeans, for example. quote: "Then one comes to a rugged stretch of coast, and after that to a certain gulfs, to a country of nomads, who get their livelihood from camels. For they carry on war from backs of camels, travel upon them, and subsist on their milk and flesh." Accurate enough.
This river flows, clearly Arab right there.
Exactly. "A river flows through their country that brings down gold dust, but the inhabitants do not know how to work it." This is not. They are called Dabay, another tribe. Some of them are nomads, whereas others are also farmers, similar to the Nabataeans. This is my favorite part. "I am not giving most of the names of the tribes because of their insignificance and at the same time because of the oddity of pronunciations."
If I can't say it, if I can't pronounce it, I won't mention it.
Oh, sorry. That's freaking perfect, isn't it? I won't go into his entire description, but it is interesting. He likes to talk about what each land's resources are, which is usually somewhat accurate.
What's the inaccurate part? You said a river flows through their country that brings
down... that they can't, like, they can't process the gold, because that's not true.
Okay, yeah.
That's just not true. The first people above Syria to dwell in Arabia Felix are the Nabataeans, inaccurate, but okay, and the Sabaeans. They overran Syria before they became subjects of the Romans. But at present, both they and the Syrians are subject to the Romans. The metropolis of the Nabataeans is Petra, as it is called, for it lies on a site which otherwise smooth and level, but is fortified all around by a rock. The outside parts of the site being precipitous and sheer, and the inside parts having springs in abundance, both for domestic purposes and watering gardens." This is accurate. And this is kind of the image you should get when you think of the Nabataeans, the sort of people in the rock face that build their cities using the spring water. So we should start off by talking about their origins specifically.
Yeah.
There's three general theories of where their origins lie. The preferred theory is that they're from the Hejaz region because of their similarity of their religion and their language to the people who eventually became the Hejazis later on. Hejaz being Western Saudi Arabia today. There's also a theory that they come from the Mesopotamian region because of there's a similarly named people who existed there during the Golden Age of Islam, during the Middle Ages.
But that doesn't seem to be good. Because these guys predate Islam by 1,000 years or something.
Exactly. So like it's less likely, but I wanted to talk about somebody who is known as Ibn Washiya, the Nabataean. He wrote a treatise about farming methods that were very advanced, and he also attempted to translate the Egyptian hieroglyphs, so we might talk about him in the future, and I just wanted to name shout. And finally, there's a theory that they come from Yemen because of some of the modern day tribes who live in the area are from the Qahtani branch of Arabs. Not necessarily one-to-one.
Yeah, it doesn't add up to much anyways, because like these, they're just I mean, they're kind of legends anyways, right?
It's kind of legends, and also it's perfectly possible that the Nabateans moved on and that another people replaced them, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so the Nabateans have been associated by other groups who are often similarly named, the Nabaiti, you know, close enough, and they were named by the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal and described as living in, quote, in a far-off desert where there are no wild animals and not even the birds build their nests. They were associated by some Nabateans due to their similar names and images, so, you know.
But, I mean, it sounds very Arab-like anyways, because, like, I mean, a lot, what they say about the Bedouin nomads, you know, eating milk, that they live off of milk and fresh animal meat.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're just nomads wandering around. Actually, there's even this account by Diodorus, who is Diodorus, who is a historian.
Diodorus Siculus.
Sorry.
Diodorus, stupid pronunciation.
It's very hard. Well, this is what he says about the Nabateans. Quote, he says, they live in the open air, claiming as native land a wilderness that has neither rivers nor abundant springs from which it is possible for a hostile army to obtain water, which is already pretty good strategically.
It lets you know that they can't be conquered.
Exactly, because they're living in the desert and there's no water nowhere. So, very hard. It is their custom neither to plant grain, set out any fruit-bearing trees, use wine, nor construct any house. And if anyone is founding acting contrary to this, death is his penalty. They follow this custom because they believe that those who possess these things are in order to retain the use of them, easily compelled by the powerful to their bidding. To do their bidding, sorry. Some of them raise camels, others sheep, pasturing them in the desert. So already right now, what he's describing is the Nabateans before they became a civilization, when they were still like a nomadic people. He also goes on to say they are exceptionally fond of freedom. And whenever a strong force of enemies comes near them, they take refuge in the desert, using this as a fortress. For it lacks water and cannot be crossed by others. But to them alone, since they have prepared subterranean reservoirs lined with stucco, it furnishes safety. So basically what he was talking about is just how these guys, they love their freedom because they're nomads. They can't, like unconquerable, and they kind of live independent a
exactly.
little bit.
Exactly, and they have these secret wells. And that's the... Honestly, that's the key to understanding the Nabateans is these secret wells that he's talking about. They are the ones who control the trade routes because they know where the wells are and they know how to go from one to the other. And they cannot be conquered because the enemies do not know where they are.
They're masters of their own environment. Really.
Exactly, you know.
And this is before they're even a civilization, actually. So it's interesting to see how they transformed themselves.
Okay, but they didn't always live there. So when they migrated north into what is now southern Jordan, southern Israel, there was a pre-existing Arab population there as well, or east of them, in northern Saudi, and they were called the Kedarites. And we actually talked about that specific group of Arabs
in the second episode.
In the second episode about Ashurbanipal, for example, like and the Assyrian Empire, and them fighting against the Assyrian Empire.
Yeah, just to recap, they ganged up with a lot of other groups of peoples to go fight the imperial army of the Assyrians.
Exactly, the evil empire of this early world.
Yeah, they contributed something along like 1,000 camels for that battle.
Exactly, and although in that battle they managed to turn the king around, eventually Assyrians kept chipping away, and they eventually managed to subjugate the Kedarites and the other people of the southern Levant in this region, but not the Nabateans, who were further south.
Yeah, the Qadarites were Arabs, by the way, guys.
And actually, by tradition, there's two of the sons of Ishmael are Kedar and Nabioth. Okay. And so that's what we think that those two branches are, right?
Oh, you mean the Nabatean term comes from Nabioth, the son of one of the Ishmael's kids.
And the other one of the other ones is called Kedar. So they have this, by tradition, this is the relation.
It follows the Arab tradition of genealogy.
Exactly. And depending on the author, well, I read this somewhere, but depending on the author, Muhammad,
the prophet Muhammad,
he can be considered either one or the other. Like, he's often related to either one of the sons, but...
It's possible, but...
It's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they had frequent wars with the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and they constantly were trying to break away from them. And frequently this caused huge amounts of violence in their, and, you know, destruction. Either on the Assyrian side, where, like, the local people who supported them were being attacked by the Arabs, or the Arabs were being destroyed by the Assyrian army. Frequently, actually, almost half of the rulers of the Kedarites that are listed are women, weirdly enough. So there's these warrior Arab women fighting against the evil empire. Yeah, you know, it's great stories, eh? One of these battles happened in 690, where they captured the Kedarite queen, and she was brought back to Assyria's and other the Assyrian capital with the loot that they captured from the Arabs, including the divine images of the tribe, and they are mentioned in the annals of the Assyrian monarchs as being conquered repeatedly by different, you know, emperors. The last time this happened was a revolt against the last great Assyrian emperor, Ashurbanipal, who was known as the king of the four corners of the earth and the king of the universe. So he had a great opinion of himself.
He had a big, big ego, man. Yeah. Big ego.
Oh my God. Anyways, they were led by two Arab kings, Amuladin and Yuta. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. And they eventually had to flee to the Nabataean kingdom for protection after they lost. And it records how the Nabataeans were forced to give him up. They fled to the Nabataeans and is subsequently captured and sentenced in the great city of Nineveh. And he records, Ashurbanipal records himself, and he relates that, quote, "I put a dog chain upon him and made him guard a kennel."
Man, these guys are intense, man.
Yeah, I know. Freak.
They literally... Assyrians?
Jesus. Anyways, eventually, Yuta's sister was appointed his successor and later led another rebellion against Ashurbanipal, which he had to put down again. And they led armies all the way into Damascus, up to north, and it was a massive campaign at the end of his life to try to put down this Arab revolt.
It's crazy, really, how early Arabs really had a lot of women leaders. She's not the first. Well, you guys are going to find out about Zenobia, but that's...
That's, like, the cool one. Anyways, point being... That's the story of the Kedarites and the Nabataeans. But the Nabataeans moved into territory that was previously occupied by other people, specifically the Edomites and the Moabites. So the Edomites are this interesting group that we're going to keep talking about through this episode. The Edomite kingdom was destroyed during the Babylonian conquest. So after the Assyrians fell, the Babylonians decided to replace them. They had defeated the Assyrians and were like, huh, this empire business is pretty cool. Let's go ahead and carve up some of that. So they march into southern Levant, and the Edomites try to resist, and the Edomites get, you know, screwed over. It's also possible that the Edomites were potentially also pushed out by the Assyrians. One second. Sorry, we had a little bug up there. Anyways, the Edomites, they could have been replaced either by Arab tribes or destroyed by the Babylonians, or even it could have been a climate change issue. But they were part of that whole Hebrew exile into Babylonia because they joined that revolt. And yeah. So they had a relationship with them. Eventually, they became known... We think that they... became the Idumeans, which, you know, is a similar enough name, and they were in a similar territory, but they were resettled north into the area that is known as Beersheba in Israel and Hebron in the West Bank. So that region was their territory, that southern part of what is like biblical Judea. That is Idumean territory. And they continued. Eventually, they were forced by the Maccabean Revolt, much later in history, after the Hellenic period. The Maccabees revolted against the Seleucid Hellenes. I know this is a lot of history I'm giving, but the point is they were converted into Judaism, forcibly converted by this revolt.
The Edomites.
The Edomites were forcibly converted into Judaism. Previously, they were Canaanite people, so related to the Hebrews, but they were forced to convert to Judaism, and both groups adopted Aramaic as their common language. So they maintained a separate identity and perhaps a separate culture, but they were folded into Orthodox Jewish religion. So that's the Edomites. Another group, the Moabites, who occupy an area of what is now central Jordan around Amman and Madaba, that territory was Moabite territory, another Canaanite people. They were essentially the enforcers for the Assyrian and Babylonian empires, or at least just the Assyrians, and that caused them great deals of conflict with the Arabs. So eventually, there's not a lot of recording of this, but eventually their territory was just fully taken over by the Arabs. And
by the Arabs, you mean the...
the Nabataean
Arabs. The Nabataeans, yeah.
Exactly, the Nabataean Arabs. And they either pushed those people out, assimilated them, or worse. So that those people ended as a distinct group in that territory. So that Moabite territory became an Arab one.
It's very different than how Nabataeans are portrayed in other historical sources, where they're a peaceful people.
But this is a couple hundred years before that peaceful first century BCE CE era.
That's probably when they had their eyes on the prize on, you know, maybe we ought to start a kingdom here, guys.
Exactly. And the Moabites had not endeared themselves because, like, the evil empire had kept using them as their foot soldiers to crush the Arabs. So there's this conflict that seemed to exist there. But regardless, that's how that central part of Jordan became Arab. And finally, we get to the Israelites, and their brief history is pretty well known by most people, I would say. I don't know. Anyways, Israel, the Kingdom of Israel under, like, the Solomonic dynasty splits into two. Both are conquered. There's the Babylonian exile, the Persians being great humanitarians, the Cyrus the Great releases the Jews to go back, including the Edomites, too, to go back to their homeland and rebuild themselves.
So 2 points for Cyrus.
Yeah, exactly. He got a huge. He's the only one non-Jew to be described as a Messiah in the Bible.
He is known actually for to be a just leader. Even in well, the Quran doesn't call him out per se, but a lot of people think that the character, the person of Dhul-Qarnayn in the Quran, may be referred to her as this, to him. Sorry, as this just leader who goes on to treat his subjects well, I guess.
Exactly. And finally, Alexander the Great happens, so the entirety of the Eastern Mediterranean world becomes a Hellenic world. They kind of get flip-flop between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Egypt, so it's like a border region that keeps flipping. But the Seleucids eventually take control. They try to, like, make the Jews more religiously similar to the Greeks, and that causes a problem and a massive
forced assimilation.
But it was a massive religious revolt called the Maccabees. They win. They found a new dynasty of the Israelite kingdom. They unite them, and they convert all these related people around them, including the Edomians, who may be the ancestors of the descendants of the Edomites. But they could also be, and this is relevant for later, they could have also been an Arab tribe who was converted as well. That's another theory.
That's a possibility, yeah.
It's very much a possibility.
But this is all of the Nabataeans' neighbors, if you like. So just to give you guys a picture of who they were interacting with.
Exactly. And these are all the people who existed to their north. To the south were further down Arab peoples who were related in a closer way. But the Nabataeans had moved north into this world of the southern Levant with the Israelites and specifically the Aramaeans, who were further even northeast with everything from Damascus north was Aramaean. Fully Aramaean, but everybody in this region also spoke Aramaean as like a lingua franca. And by Jesus' time, and this is well known, he would have spoken Aramaean as his first language. Hebrew would have been the religious language spoken. You
know? A little bit like Latin.
A bit like Latin.
And, you know, the common language would be English. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the common language would be English, but the religious language would be Latin.
Exactly. And to give people an idea of the geography that we're talking about, because the Nabataeans, like, they made their they made their name in trade. They were known for their trade routes, their control and mastery of the desert trade in the Arabian Peninsula. So basically, there was two ways to trade with India. There was the overland route and the
by sea.
And in the Yemeni episode, we talked about the sea route and how that was important to Yemen. But also, from Yemen, the incense and the spices and all the gold and stuff, it could move over north by land.
Through caravans.
Exactly, through camel caravans.
And this would usually go by Nabataean territory.
Yes. It would always go through Nabataean territory because they controlled all the trade routes in the northern half. And they would be the ones trading all the way from Yemen all the way to the end point, which was Gaza. The port of Gaza was the most important southern port along this coast. Eventually, a place called Caesarea was built by King Herod, and we'll get to that later. But it still remained that Gaza was the perfect port. And so there was this north-south road from Gaza all the way to Yemen. And then there was an east-west road from Egypt to Damascus. And then there was a bunch of crisscrossing roads from like Jerusalem to Petra to south. So all these routes were controlled by the Nabataeans. And in the south, actually, there was a place called Ayla, which is modern-day Aqaba, which could link up this overland trade with the Red Sea trade as well.
It's well-placed for that, too.
Exactly. So the Nabataeans were perfectly placed to move goods, lighter goods usually, but goods nonetheless of high value and low weight.
I mean, I would imagine this would make them very, very rich. It's also one of the reasons, because they were very, very low-key for a long time.
Exactly.
But this control of the route, of these trade routes, made them so rich, Rome just couldn't ignore them anymore.
Exactly. And they controlled the trade of frankincense, myrrh, clothing, salt, sulfur / bitumen. There's a wide range of uses for them. And this would be mined from the Dead Sea as well. So it was a local product. Balsam oil as a medicine. And also, of course, gold that would be mined from either Egypt or Ethiopia. And they received a lot of finished goods, probably food as well, other you know, goods made in the Mediterranean world, which they would trade back and forth. But the Mediterranean world would have received these other goods that we just mentioned. And what's interesting is this is a rocky territory. So there's this mountain chain that runs through the center of Jordan, and it's very difficult to cross, so you have to go up and down. And even for a camel, it's quite an arduous journey. They built roads, and they built like wide staircases up and down these mountains to facilitate this trade eventually.
Interesting.
Neat, huh?
It really is, yeah.
And this was later improved upon by the Romans themselves, who were, you know, master road builders themselves.
I mean, this is man adapting environment to his needs.
And it's not just Petra. It was Petra, Basra in southern Syria. There's a number of locations in the Negev Desert in southern Israel today called Memphis, Abta, Subaita, all of which are so beautiful. They're small settlements, but they're big. They're quite large for how many people would have lived there. They were wealthy. They had space and water to feed water the camels and the rest of it. And these were the stopping points between the locations. And the Nabataeans, in their agriculture, were able to make this desert land bloom. Now, it might have been easier back in the day because there was a higher level of rainfall, but still, this was a desert, a hostile place.
So they were able to kind of, not create oases, but...
Yeah, create oases, artificial really? Oases. Yeah.
Look out.
And like, as beautiful an oasis as you can think of in your head. Like, yeah. But regardless,
imagine that, creating an oasis right in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, I know, freak. It's amazing. And Petra itself would have resembled something, and we're going to get to a little bit more of the details later, but it would have resembled something like a mix of Dubai, Las Vegas, and what was the other one I thought about? I don't know, regardless. Think of it like as a mix of Dubai, Las Vegas, and Athens all rolled into one. It's this amazing, beautiful city. But I also wanted to talk about the Jewish neighbors of the people there. Because There's something of a history of Arabs and Jews that is talked about in modern day, and it's usually talked about in a way of like, oh, they've always been fighting, you know.
Which is far from the case.
I know. But regardless, we should talk about it because this is an interesting period of history. And the person I want to talk about it through is somebody known to the West as Herod the Great. Now, he has a... Let's be charitable and call it a controversial history with religions of the area, including Jews and Christians. Now, he's not a popular figure for either. But if anybody's seen the HBO series on Rome, he's the guy who shows up in the second season, and he shows up to go basically bribe Mark Antony to make him basically king of the Jews. He's called the Tetrarch of Galilee. So he's like the kind of like the Duke of Northern Israel today, and his father was like the Romans' point man up there. Like, he was like their guy. He was their best shot. And his father was an Idumean, so possibly an Edomite or an Arab. And his mother was definite. His mother Cypros was a Nabatean Arab princess, so he was at least half Arab. And even his father's side was not fully, like, Hebrew Jewish. He was Jewish by religion.
So he could have probably had some Arab on his father's side as well.
Exactly. He was either fully Arab or half Arab. And he was possibly also, he was Jewish by religion. But his ancestry was not Hebrew, which didn't make him a popular figure anyways. Some people,
so he's a convert, or not him per se, but
his ancestors
yeah, were converts during Judaism
a couple hundred years before, or yeah, like 100 years before by the Maccabees. he likely actually spent a few years in Petra actually. So he would have been familiar with the city and lived there for a while in his younger years. His father was eventually appointed Antipater, or, you know, Tetrarch, or whatever the title we're going to say, of Galilee by Julius Caesar himself.
Oh.
So this is the period of time we're talking
about. This guy was pretty high up.
No, he was very high up. Yeah, and so the father and son both built their reputations for being good enforcers for Rome, collecting taxes and crushing bandits slash rebels. Which was a whole thing among... after the revolt of the Maccabees, Jews had become very famous for rising up against their Hellenic overlords. He built his power by backing the Caesarian faction in the civil wars. So after Caesar's assassinated, there's a bunch of civil wars. He's always backing the Caesarians, although even though they split up and he has to pick sides eventually. and he eventually gets named King of the Jews. He was hated by religious Jews for his Roman connections, his high taxes, and his lavish lifestyle. So, you know,
he wasn't living up to the Jewish name.
No, he was not. He was not popular with them. And I would say this: he's even less popular with Christians. Let's put it that way. But he did found the ancient city of Caesarea Maritima, which is this beautiful, like, Roman style, almost capital on the west coast, like halfway between Haifa and Tel Aviv today. There's Caesarea, and he actually spent most of his time there because it was like a Hellenic city that was more favorable to his rule, whereas the more conservative Jews who lived around Jerusalem didn't like him having him around very much. So the coast of what is now modern day Israel was more his territory and more amenable to his way of doing things. Even though, again, he was like a religious Jew, circumcised, wear the everything, you know.
Well, it's kind of like a conflict between the more conservative, if you want to say, like,
oh god,
one of the more conservative branch of Judaism, well, Jews versus the more
liberal-ish kind of. Yeah, exactly. Like the liberals living on the beaches and the conservatives living up in the hills. it was a thing. But regardless, this was he facilitated the trade between Arabs and Jews, and there was actually like this boat system on the Dead Sea where they'd like trade across the Dead Sea in this like mini, like the Dead Sea is this like depression deep south under the sea level, and it's the saltiest sea in the world, and people obviously know about it.
I mean, you can float in it, by the way.
Yeah, everybody can float in it, but like you will not sink in the sea. It is too salty. And so the camels would bring it to the coast of the sea. They take it on a ship, bring it over to the other side. And every night they had to take the boats out, because if they left them in, the salt would accumulate on the bottom and you couldn't use the boat. Exactly. And this is like the friendly relations. So there was like one war fought between the Arabs and the Jews, but all throughout that history, there was mostly just intermarriages. Jewish kings married Nabataean princesses and vice versa. And actually, the sister of Herod, Salome the First, she actually cheated on her husband with Seleucus, a prime minister of the Nabataeans, or like a minister of the Nabataeans. So it's like this like love story between an Arab man and a Jew, and you know,
this is probably where all the hate began.
Oh God, no, no. Well, speaking of controversial things.
Yes.
This is where we get into the Christian / Christmas narrative. This is literally the story of the Nativity. So we're like, people, if they know their history, know that we're kind of getting to zero CE or AD. Like, this is originally a Christian religious calendar, and zero is traditionally when Jesus was born.
Yeah.
And so throughout this period, Herod is gaining power. He eventually dies a couple years into the CE, but towards the end of his reign, he had heard a legend of a king of the Jews being born in Bethlehem. And this is the Christian narrative behind it. So the Bible records the nativity as happening in Bethlehem because Jesus's, I guess, stepfather, what was his name again?
Okay. Joseph.
Joseph, yes, sorry. I'm blanking now.
Yeah.
He had to go get recorded for tax purposes at Bethlehem. And he couldn't stay in any of, like, the rooms because they'd all been lent out. So he had to sleep in a, you know, manger in the stables. And that's the story of, like, this very, the king of the Jews being born in, like, this very humble place. And he's visited by three magi, or wise men. These wise men are, by tradition, they're not actually said to be three in the Bible. It's just by tradition that they're three. And usually they're represented as, like, a Persian, an Ethiopian, and an Arab.
Okay, and
more importantly, this trade route, like, they're traders. They are part of this trade route that we're describing. This is the context of that story. And Bethlehem was along the way, like, was on the road to Jerusalem as a trade spot.
So that Arab wise man must have probably been a Nabataean.
Not just that. It's like this whole system is the Nabataean system. It's their trade system. It's their roads.
You know, there's one thing that you mentioned when you said that at the end of his reign, he found out about the birth of the king of all Jews.
Yes.
I imagine that would probably piss him off, since he was considering himself as the king of all Jews, right?
Exactly. So this is the period of time known as the Massacre of the Innocents, which, you know, is just like a great name. So part of the story of Christmas, or Al-Milad, the birth, the nativity, is what happened before and during. The New Testament Gospel of Matthew records Matthew 2:16 to 2:18. It records his reaction and his response to this and it's known as the Massacre of the Innocents. King Herod the Great, king of the Judea, orders the execution of all male children 2 years old and under in the vicinity of Bethlehem.
It's a pretty big reaction, man.
This is not attested to in any other document other than the Bible. So it's hard to say what this is from. Is it true? Is it not? It is part of the Christian tradition. And it is still, like, they are considered by Catholics and other Christians as the first martyrs of the faith before Jesus. They're the first Christian martyrs. And it's actually celebrated to this day on December 28th as the Feast of the Holy Innocents. The majority of scholars of Herod and Herod's biography, and probably the majority of biblical scholars, still hold that this event was a legend of some sort, of a folklore. But it is part of his, like, legacy to this day.
It's still part of the tradition.
Yeah.
You know, it's still pretty important. You know, because it's tradition, I think it'd be a good idea to read the story from the Bible, from the King James Version, right?
Absolutely. The New King James Version.
The New King James Version, yeah.
Just easier to understand, honestly.
It is, yeah, because it gets a lot. It gets pretty complicated with the those and thous and shalt.
No, not even that. It's just like they're using words like coast of something to mean beside something, and you're like, this is like older English, you know.
So this is the story. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard of this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, determined from what time the star appeared. And when he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the young child, and when you have found him, bring back word to me, that I may come and worship him also." When they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which had seen in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. And when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Then being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way. Now when they departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him." When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, "A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her child, refusing to be comforted, because they are no more." Now when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead." Then he arose, took the young child and his mother, and went into the land of Israel. But when he had heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea instead of his father, Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside into the region of Galilee. And he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, "He shall be called a Nazarene."
Ooh.
And that, folks, is the story from the Bible, from the King James Bible.
And this is the story of Christmas.
This is the story of Christmas. And this ties in perfectly well with the Nabataeans, since they did have a central part, and the Arabs, since they did play a central part in that story.
Indeed. They were both, like, King Herod in his Arab origins, and the wise men as sort of the heroes of the story in a way.
Yeah, which one of them was a Nabataean Arab.
At least.
According to tradition.
Exactly. And, like, Well, I can't say how much I liked that recording more, honestly. That was amazing job by my co-host, not going to lie.
Thank you.
All right. So I think that really concludes the first part of our podcast on the Nabataeans. We will have a second episode up very shortly. We'd like to thank everybody for your time and we hope that you enjoy this.
We especially like if you guys would like subscribe to our podcast, give us a good review on whatever platform you use. I mean, you guys can also follow us on Facebook at the 1001 Arabian Nights. That's Knights with a K, just as seen in the title. And, you know, just share, give us a comment, give us suggestions for new episodes. And yeah, I mean, catch us also on the next episode where we dive more into the Nabataean people themselves. How did they live? How did they operate? Because exactly. We kind of gave you guys a little bit of a geographical setting and who their neighbors are and how they interacted with them. But how do Nabataeans themselves set up their societies? Exactly. This is what we're going to get into the next episode.
Absolutely. And we'd love to see you guys there.
Oh, yeah. And just one little thing. Before we leave, we're going to leave you guys with some good music.
This is a little lullaby, which I feel is very appropriate given the Bible verse that we just listened to. It's a beautiful, I think it's an Egyptian lullaby. Very beautiful. I hope you guys enjoy. And have a great December. Happy holidays to those who celebrate.
Happy holidays, guys. Hope you enjoyed the show.